Jesus as Son of God, Part 1, The Apostles' Perspective, was presented by Ryan Carroll on August 7, 2011, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Hello, everybody. My name is Ryan Carroll. If you were around when I had the opportunity to teach last time, you're going to be sorely disappointed to hear some of the same. And if you're new here, I'm not one of the common teachers, but I've been given an opportunity. I'm a student of the Bible, and it's something that I take pretty seriously. And I've got some things that I'd like to talk about for the next 2 weeks. So with that in mind, before I kind of jump in, I'm going to be talking about a subject that is, for some interesting reasons, sort of near and dear to my heart, and that is the question of the nature of Jesus. I just want everyone to know that, you know, this isn't the only thing that I think about, but it is a topic that has been, for me personally, important for a number of reasons, some of which reasons are that I've had people close to me that have been hurt by this topic, friends, family, and it also happens to be a topic that is just personally interesting to me. It's something I've been kind of wrestling with over the last couple of years. So with that in mind, I'm going to jump in. There's going to be a lot of things that I'm not able to say, and I'm hoping that you will use the question and answer time to sort of direct things to where you'd like to take it. So that said, I'm going to be teaching for 2 weeks. And sort of the question that I want to frame the 2 weeks with is, what qualified Jesus to be the Son of God? And I want to ask that from two perspectives. The first perspective is from the perspective of the apostles. What qualified, according to the apostles, Jesus to be the Son of God? And then the second perspective that I want to ask that from is, the first major church council that occurred 300 years after Jesus' life on earth, the Council of Nicaea. I want to ask that same question and have an answer according to them. What made Jesus qualified to be the Son of God? So this week I'm going to focus mainly on the first question with respect to the apostles, and then next week we'll look at the question with respect to the Council of Nicaea. Just to get things set up, though, I'm going to talk a little bit about both. So first of all, for the apostles, if you want to turn there, I'm going to turn there and read it directly. If not, feel free to just listen. But if you would turn to John chapter 20, verse 30. In John's gospel, this seems to be sort of his thesis, what he kind of, in certain respects, sums up his narrative account of Jesus' life with. And he says, many other signs, verse 30, therefore Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. So John the Apostle kind of cuts right to the heart of things and says, I'm writing this so that you know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Just want to turn to one other place, Peter's first sermon in Acts. It's just a couple pages down the road in your Bibles in chapter 2. I'm not going to give you the entire sermon, but he ends the sermon by saying, therefore, verse 36 of chapter 2 in Acts, therefore, let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him, that is Jesus, both Lord and Christ. Okay, so we have the apostles suggesting that Jesus' importance is because he is the Christ and the Son of God, okay? That's his importance. That's their focus. Jesus is the Christ. He's the Son of God. Now, there are a lot of other statements that we could look at, but now I want to flip to the Nicene Creed, which came out of that church council 300 years later. And what the Nicene Creed ends up saying about Jesus is that Jesus is God of gods, very God of very gods, light of light, made of the same essence of the Father, pre-existent, begotten, not made. And then they go on to say, if you don't believe in any of that stuff, then you're cursed. So the question is, we have these two groups of people, and they're separated by 300 years. And as we know, the Council of Nicaea has been very formative and foundational in shaping how we as Christians, especially people who would subscribe to a more conservative, orthodox understanding of Christianity, how we understand Jesus and what his nature is. And so the question is, do the apostles, when they claim that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, do they mean the same thing as what the council produced when they said that Jesus is God of gods, very God of very gods, made of the same essence as the Father? And so that's the question. Do these translate? Do the apostles' statements mean the same thing as the church council's statements? Okay. And so what I want to do over these next 2 weeks is kind of hone in on, first, what was it that the apostles had in their minds when they were making these claims about Jesus being the Son of God? What was their assumption about Jesus' ontological nature, that is, his essence, when they're making these claims? And then if we find their assumption to be different from what it seems the Council of Nicaea's assumption, working assumptions were, then next week we want to ask the question, well, why 300 years later is there a completely new set of working assumptions with respect to Jesus' ontological identity? So if we are to take the Bible seriously, well, first of all, come on, Ryan, why does this matter? Well, I do want to say that my goal by the end of next week is to move from the theoretical interest to the more personal existential aspect of this question. I do want to sort of recognize that this question is not altogether important to a lot of people. A lot of personal friends, family members are just kind of like, well, okay, yeah, so. And so what I want to try to do ultimately is sort of get to the place where we can talk about, why does this matter? Why is this important personally? So to begin with, I think if we're going to take the biblical account seriously, we need to be willing to scrutinize why we have this difference in language, seeming difference in language, between the apostles holding Jesus up and saying he's the Messiah, he's the Son of God. On the other hand, the Nicene creedalists holding up, saying, well, no, he's just God. He's God of gods, made of the same essence as the transcendent creator. And I think ultimately, if we're going to take the Bible seriously, we have to be willing to scrutinize this language. And we have to be willing to give, I think, more weight ultimately to where the apostles are coming from, given the fact that God has appointed the apostles to be our guides, our eyewitnesses to the gospel. Okay? All right. Now, I've already tipped my hand. I'm going to answer the question. These two groups aren't saying the same thing about Jesus. I'm going to suggest that the apostles, when they speak of Jesus as the Son of God, they are talking about his identity, and that the Nicene Creed is very much talking and focused on Jesus' biological essence, his ontology. Okay? So now what we want to do is we want to kind of flesh this out for the apostles. How do we know what the apostles thought about Jesus and his nature, given that this has seemingly become sort of utmost importance 300 years later to the Council of Nicaea and then down through church history. It seems like we ought to really try to grasp what prior assumptions the apostles were bringing to their interactions with Jesus and what they were saying ultimately about him once he ascended to the Father. Okay. So, first of all, with respect to the titles, when the apostles call Jesus Christ, Son of Man, Son of God, King of Kings, Image of God, Lord, what was their understanding of these titles? What prior assumption did they bring to them? Was their assumption that the man who was going to be given these titles be physically different in nature than they themselves, or not? Okay. And so what I want to do is do a bit of review, especially for those of you who were here a couple years ago when I taught on Colossians, to ask the questions where these titles come from. If we can understand and know where these titles come from, then we get a clearer grasp of hopefully what sort of is in the background and the prior assumptions that the apostles are bringing to these titles. Okay, so we need to start back with the covenant that God made with David back in 2 Samuel chapter 7. You can turn there or not. I'm going to go ahead and read it for you. Okay, so what my contention is that all of these titles that the apostles have granted to Jesus, they all come back to and are rooted in this particular passage in 2 Samuel 7 where God comes to David and promises to not only continue to allow him to be king over Israel, but to continue to allow his children's children's children to be king over Israel. Okay. And the background is that we have to remember that David was a successor to Saul in Israel, and that Saul ended up doing enough evil in the eyes of God that God decided to disqualify him from continuing to be the king over Israel. Now, David has it in his mind that he wants to build a temple for Yahweh. And so he tells his ideas to Samuel, I think it was. Nathan. And Nathan hears from God with respect to David's interest in building him a house, a temple. And God says to Nathan, tell David, I'm not interested in him building me a house, okay? But I'm actually going to build him a house. And that's where we pick up in verse, let's pick up in verse 10. Let's just pick up in verse 8. Okay. Now, therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture and from following the sheep, that you should be ruler over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make you a great name, like the names of the great men who are on the earth. I will also appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them that they may live in their own place and not be disturbed again. Nor will the wicked afflict them any more as formerly, even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Okay, so David, I'm going to give you rest. I'm going to, create a place for my people. I'm going to plant them in peace. And then he says, the Lord also declares to you that he will make you a house. Okay. So David, I'm not interested in you building me a physical building, but I'm going to make you a house. And so the question is, what does he have in mind? Then he goes on, verse 12. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up a descendant or a seed after you who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So before I move on, what seems to be going on is that when God says to David, I'm going to build you a house, what he means is, I am going to create a lineage, a dynasty of rulers that are going to come forth from you. So then he says, one who comes after you, a descendant who I'm going to raise up after you, he's going to actually build me a house. And as we know, that ends up being Solomon. Solomon is David's heir. And so he's going to build a house for my name, verse 13, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever, just like I'm promising to do with you, I'm going to do with him. Verse 14, I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. So this portion of what God is telling him is specifically about David. I just want you to know that the promise that I'm making you is in terms of having one of your descendants on the throne of Israel forever is going to stand. Even if you and or your seed, your descendants, after you screw up royally, like Saul did, I am not going to remove my faithfulness from your family. I will continue to affirm and confirm and appoint your descendants as kings of Israel. And then he goes on to say, verse 15, but my loving kindness will not depart as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you, and your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David. Okay, now, the heart of the issue concerning the titles that are ascribed to Jesus comes from this particular passage back up in verse, I believe it's 14, when God says, I will be a father to him, that is David, you and your descendants, and he will be a son to me. Now, the question is, what does God have in mind when he's using that language? And as most of you know, I have proposed that what he's doing is he is borrowing language from the surrounding nations of the ancient Near East with regard to the relational status that they believed their kings had vis-a-vis their gods, okay? And especially Egypt's, all right? So it seems to be the case, based on archaeological evidence, especially dug up in Egypt, that the Egyptians called their king the Son of God, okay? And they just had a different name for their god. Their main god was Re. And the point is that you get the impression from the evidence that has been dug up that, for example, the son of Re held the authority and the status of Re himself, okay, was considered to be the man who was the literal, physical, visible embodiment of their invisible god that they couldn't see, okay? And so this whole notion of the divine right of kings that we see kind of coming down through the ages, even through until the kings of England, was really started back here in the ancient Near East with the kings and their god. So the language son, when God applies it to David, and I think that's the language that he has in mind, and when these other surrounding nations applied it to their kings, most likely it was not the belief of these peoples that their king was some literal physical offspring descended from heaven, come down to earth to sort of be God. Okay, the language is highly metaphorical, all right? And there is evidence of, most notably, the enthronement ceremonies when these children who were appointed to be the next heir of the pharaohs in Egypt, for example, when they were actually, when they came to the age where they were actually crowned and enthroned and given the authority, it was at that point that they, we have evidence that they were considered to be begotten by their gods. Today I have begotten you. Now, that is language that was used in Egypt prior to the kings in Israel, specifically in Psalm 2, having it used for them and their enthronement ceremonies. So this son, father, begotten language, it seems to be very, very metaphorical in nature. Now, I'm not going to spend a ton of time here, and if you have questions about some of that, I want to kind of move on. But the point is this, that it seems to be the case that when David is, when God makes this covenant with David, what he's saying to David is, David, I am going to make you and your descendants my physical, visible representative on earth. Okay? David, you are my son. You will rule over my people. And the evidence that we get from the Psalms is that, and I'm not going to go through all of the evidence, and again, you can kind of take me back there in the question and answer time, but what we sort of pick up from David's understanding of this covenant is that David understood a number of things, that as the son, he was literally sitting on the throne of God himself. That symbolically he sat on Yahweh's throne as the visible representative of Yahweh. Next, he was elevated in status to a little lower than God. That is, in Psalm 8, we get the sense that David, when by being made the son of man, that he has been elevated to a little lower than the status of God. That is, that in essence, there is no one more important in creation, David or David's descendants, than you, because you rule visibly for Yahweh. You are Yahweh's representative. Also, there was the sense that the Son was going to rule over all of Yahweh's creation and the nations and Israel. And so the King of Israel, the Son of Yahweh, wasn't simply a political ruler over Israel, but he also, as being the physical, visible, tangible representative of God himself, ruled over God's entire creation and ruled over all of the nations. Okay. Lots of sort of passages that I could point to. Again, if you're interested in going there, we can do that. So sort of to recap, the titles Messiah, Son, Son of Man, Son of God, are all titles that David held and that each of his succeeding sons ruling over Israel also held. Okay? And as you notice, these are titles that are given to mere men. So when the Psalms speak to these titles, they are not speaking ontologically with respect to some kind of biological, physical relationship that the king has to God. But these titles seem to be honing in and getting at a status and authority that these titles hold with them as the person that God has decided to vest his authority within creation on. Okay? So, the question begs to be answered. Well, if these titles were given to men and had their appropriate use was with respect to status and authority, then why would it be different in the New Testament when the apostles begin to grant these titles to Jesus? Why would we go and think, oh, they must be talking about Jesus' ontological identity in relationship to God rather than his status and authority, just as David held? Okay. So just ruminate on that for a second. Now, the problem is that David was promised that one of his descendants would continually be on the throne of Israel. Well, it doesn't take too much in terms of the history of Israel, too much down the road to realize that this promise of a perpetual king on the throne of Israel doesn't seem to go too well. There are many other nations around that have a much bigger stick than Israel did back in those days. Babylon, Assyria seem to kind of get in the way of Israel continuing to be able to govern itself and to keep a king on its throne. So I've answered question one. What is the apostles' prior assumptions when they are ascribing titles to Jesus? It seems to be the case that from the evidence that we have, that it can be assumed that the apostles wouldn't necessarily be bringing an a priori assumption about Jesus's ontological identity by using those titles. Okay, these were titles that were given to men, and that by using these titles, they are pointing to a status and authority they believed Jesus to hold. Okay, so that's the question of titles. Now, back to sort of what happens after the line of David kind of gets cut off by the Babylonian captivity. There's another question. There are a number of prophecies about the son who was to come. Okay. Once the line of David kind of gets cut off for a time, the question arose from the Jews themselves, is God still faithful? Are we still his people? Is he still going to ultimately fulfill the promises to David to have one of his descendants ruling over us in perpetuity? And is God, I mean, has God rejected us as a people in general? Okay. And so there's this question of prophetic assumption that the apostles had to kind of work through. And there, as mentioned, there are prophecies concerning this future son that seem to intimate possibly that, at least we've been taught, that seem to intimate that the future prophesied about Son of God would be different than David in his ontological identity. And the one that is most notable is in Isaiah 9. So if you want to go to Isaiah 9 real quickly, I'm just going to kind of cruise through it. And again, I'm doing no justice to any of this. This is really something that should be done in like 10 weeks rather than two. So apostles' a priori understanding with respect to the titles, they don't seem to have any a priori assumptions that they're bringing in, that these titles carry any biological markers or ontological identity with them. Now, what about the prophecies? And in Isaiah 9, we have that famous prophecy about the son. And I'm going to read it for you real quickly here. Isaiah 9, chapter 6, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, and Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on forevermore." Okay, there's a lot that I could do here, but I just want to point out that there is nothing about this particular passage that requires us to believe or to understand that when this future son of David shows up, that he is going to be God, okay? Biologically, in essence, God. Specifically, if you notice, if you're coming at this passage in the time of Isaiah, when Isaiah writes to them, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us," he is not focusing in on the sex of the child. Okay. That is of not sort of interest to the prophecy. When the term son got used by Isaiah there, there would be no doubt for his listeners and his readers that, that this was a specific key sort of word that they would understand with respect to the line of Davidic kings. Okay. Now, especially since that after he says a son will be given to us, he connects this idea of the son being given with governmental authority. He says, and the government will rest on his shoulders. There, it seems to me that he has to be speaking with respect to that Davidic fulfillment, that son of David who would come. Again, it seems to me that the only assumption that we can make at this point is that the ontology of this individual would have to be someone who is physically related to David as a human being. Okay. So then the question is, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, and Prince of Peace. Well, how can an individual who is going to come eventually be called Mighty God and Eternal Father unless he was Mighty God and Eternal Father? Well, in Egypt, and I'm going to make the case that that's probably what was going on here, is when these individuals who came to be the next pharaoh were enthroned, they were given royal names. And their royal names were to be indicative of their identity as the son of the god that they were representing. And so the royal names that the Egyptian pharaohs were often given were literally like these in the sense that they were simply titles. They were names to denote that special status, that significance, that status, that authority that this particular man, individual held vis-a-vis his god. Okay. And so it seems to me that it wouldn't at all be out of line to suggest that that's what would be going on here. I'm not going to spend any more time there. I'm just going to float that out there. And then verse 7, there will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom. Well, no end to the increase of his government. Well, that seems like someone's going to have to live an awful long time. Can any mere human being do that? Well, that's the question. But I want to suggest that the promise to David back in 2 Samuel was for one of David's descendants to rule in perpetuity. Back in 2 Samuel chapter 7, you don't get the notion of whether or not God has in mind a particular individual, one individual who will end up ruling forever, or whether he has in mind just a continuation of the descendancy and the heirs that will continue on. Here it seems that Isaiah is pointing to one individual, but I just want to point out that for someone to end up ruling in perpetuity only requires that God sustain that individual's life. And all of us actually are eternal moving forward. We all have a destiny. We will all be raised again, either to judgment or to life. In this case, I just read resurrection from the dead. Now, so what I'm going to suggest is that I haven't covered all of the prophecies, but I think I've covered the most important one. Could the apostles have brought with them a prior assumption for Jesus being ontologically God based on, for example, this prophetic statement? And the answer is no. There is no requirement for ontology with this sort of prophecy. Now, we're in the New Testament, okay? And what I want to do is sort of bore you to death with tedium of sort of going through and asking the question, based on the evidence that we see in the New Testament, are the apostles pointing to someone who was going to be and fulfill the Davidic line of David and being the appointed ruler of God over Israel and over creation? Or are they pointing to Jesus being God of gods and very God of very gods. Okay. Now, so I just kind of want everyone to sort of start in Matthew. We're just going to kind of cruise through. I'm just going to point out some stuff. Want to start in the Gospels. What do the Gospel accounts have to say? Do they lend us or let us in on what kind of assumptions the apostles have about Jesus? Is he the Messiah, the Son of David, or is he supposed to be God of gods? So, Matthew chapter 1, we have the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And then Matthew takes us through and gives us an understanding of how Jesus is literally the physical descendant of David. Okay. Then what we have the same thing in Luke. There's another genealogy with respect to Jesus in Luke chapter 3. These genealogies are different. There's lots of reasons why people explain their differences. I'm not even sure if anyone in this room cares why they're different. If you care, ask me. But I think one is Joseph's line and one's Mary's line. We can talk about that if you want to. So right off the bat, New Testament, this man is connected physically to David. Okay. Now, what about the people's perception? What was their Messiah, their Christ, supposed to be? Well, you have lots of data where people are pointing to him and saying, is he the son of David? Jesus, son of David. You've got the blind men in Matthew 9, calling to the son of David to come heal him. You've got the multitudes after Jesus performs a miracle in Matthew chapter 12, verse 23, wondering if this Jesus that they're seeing perform these miracles is the son of David. You've got in Matthew chapter 15, the Canaanite woman who comes to Jesus begging for him to heal her son. And she said, and her approach to him is, Jesus, son of David, please come and heal my son. And that's when he says, you know, I don't really want to because you're not a Jew. And she says, well, yes, but even the dogs get the crumbs off the master's table and blah, 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 which is a beautiful thing. But again, her approach to him, her understanding was that this was the man who was going to be the son of David. Again, more blind men in Matthew chapter 20. Jesus, Lord, son of David, come heal us. Matthew chapter 21, Jesus enters into Jerusalem for the last time on the back of the donkey, palm branches in hand. Everyone thinks that he is the son of David. Hosanna to the son of David. They think he's coming into Jerusalem to set up the kingdom of God. They believed, their understanding was that he was the one who was going to be David's ultimate successor. Matthew 22, Jesus questions the Pharisees, whose son is the Christ? And they answer, he's David's son. Okay. Then there's this other exchange, and we can talk about that if you want to. But it goes on. In Luke spends a number of places in Luke chapter 1 and 2 pointing to the fact that Joseph, Jesus' father, is the son of, or in the descendancy of David. Luke chapter 1, verse 32, Gabriel speaking to Mary, saying that the one that is going to come forth from you is going to be and take upon himself the throne of his father David. I could go on and on. Every time the word Christ, the word Messiah, gets used in the New Testament, it is pointing back to this sort of the connotation of these titles are pointing directly back to the individual who the Jews were hoping would fulfill the promises of God for them and for the world and set up the kingdom of God and the kingdom of Israel again and vanquish the enemies of God. Okay. The assumption was that this individual had to be simply of the line of David. That was the basic requirement. Okay. Now, continuing on, want to look at a few things that the apostles speak to in that regard. If you would turn to Acts chapter 2, verse 22, men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. This man, delivered up by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death, and God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power. For David says of him, I was always beholding the Lord in my presence, for he is at my right hand, that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad. Skipping down, verse 29, brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David that he has both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. And so, because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn to him with an oath to seat one of his descendants upon his throne, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of the Messiah, that he was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. This Jesus God raised up again, to which we are all witnesses. Therefore, having been exalted to the right hand of God, et cetera, just know that he is God has made him both Lord and Christ. Acts chapter 13, Paul's first real sermon in Acts. Before we go there, I just want to point out to you that Peter's entire focus is on Jesus's physical relationship to David and the fact that he was raised from the dead. That is his focus. So we're going to see this theme again and again as I hit you with more verses ad nauseum, that it seems to be the case that, unlike the Council of Nicaea, whose requirement of Jesus was that he had a physical nature that was of the same essence of God, the apostles seem to require that Jesus was the physical descendant of David and that he was resurrected from the dead. And that's what you will find throughout sort of the New Testament, is the assumption, the working assumption that the apostles seem to be going with, is that their focus is on his relationship to David and his resurrection. And the question has to be asked, is it entering their mind at all that this physical descendant of David is ontologically somehow the same guy who purportedly helped God create the universe and was preexistent before the dawn of time? So in Acts chapter 13, we see the same thing. Sort of Paul is taking people through a history of Israel. He talks about Saul in verse 20. 17 through 19. And then in verse 20 says, and after these things, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. And then they asked for a king, and God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. And after he had removed Saul, he raised up David to be their king, concerning whom he also testified and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my heart, who will do all my will. From the offspring of this man, physical offspring of this man, according to promise, God has brought to Israel a Savior, Jesus. After John had proclaimed before his coming a baptism of repentance, blah, 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 going down through verse 29. And when they had carried out all that was written concerning Jesus, they took him down from the cross and laid him in a tomb. But God raised him from the dead, and for many days he appeared to those who came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, the very ones who are now his witnesses to the people. And we preach to you the good news of the promise made to the fathers, that God has fulfilled the promise to our children, in that he raised up Jesus, as it is also written in the second Psalm, Thou art my son, today I have begotten thee. And as for the fact that he raised him up from the dead, no more to return to decay, he has spoken in this way, I will give you the holy and sure blessings of David, that is, the blessings to rule perpetually. Therefore, he also says in another psalm, thou wilt not allow thy Holy One to undergo decay. For David, after he had served the purpose of God in his own generation, fell asleep and was laid among his fathers and underwent decay. But he whom God raised did not undergo decay. Therefore, let it be known to you, brethren, that through him, that is Jesus, forgiveness of sins is proclaimed. Again, this specific focus, what makes Jesus important to Paul here? The fact that he is the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant, that Jesus was a descendant of David, and that by God raising him from the dead, he now may rule perpetually as God's Messiah. Again, Romans chapter 1, I got two more verses that I want to just hone in on. Paul begins his entire epistle this way. Paul, verse 1, a bondservant of Christ Jesus, called as an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures concerning his son. Who's the son? Who was born of a descendant of David according to the flesh. Again, focus on David's physical lineage of Jesus's physical lineage to David. Who was declared the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. So the idea, and we see this throughout the New Testament, what was the ultimate sort of thing that the apostles point to suggest that he, this man Jesus, was David's ultimate successor? It was the fact that God raised him from the dead, okay? A descendant of David, declared the Son of God by the resurrection from the dead. Okay? Again, one last place, 2 Timothy chapter 1, excuse me, chapter 2. Paul is writing to Timothy, and he tells him a number of things about being strong and staying the course, being a good soldier in active service for Christ, blah, blah, blah. Going down to verse 8 of chapter 2, verse 7, consider what I say, for the Lord will give you understanding in everything. Remember verse 8, Jesus Christ, risen from the dead, descendant of David, according to my gospel. Again, this focus on Jesus' physical connection to David and the fact that God did not leave him dead. Now, I think what makes a whole lot of sense to me is that sort of Orthodox Trinitarianism seems to make the fact of Jesus' resurrection kind of a nonity, in the sense that if Jesus is God, then it's like he's just playing a part, and he got himself killed, and 3 days later, he got himself out from the dead, and this is just a matter of course. He's God. But the fact that the apostles seem to be so focused, and I could take you to literally 25 other verses where they talk about themselves being the witnesses to his resurrection. The fact that they are so focused on Jesus having been raised from the dead seems to me to indicate that it presupposes on their part that they understand that Jesus' nature is of such a constitution that resurrection wasn't a foregone conclusion, if that makes sense. It just has to be the case that resurrection was not a foregone conclusion for the apostles to so adamantly and forcefully and so often point to the fact of Jesus' resurrection. Now, boy, I'm sure there are a lot of holes. Couple things. First of all, one problem. What about the virgin birth? It's a good question. And it's actually the one that I remember asking myself back when I was wrestling with this issue and trying to kind of sort my own sort of ideas and self out on that. But what I've come to is the fact that the virgin birth is like, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, my mom had like two of them. I'm joking. But the virgin birth is talked about twice, once in Matthew and once in Luke. The other two gospel accounts don't talk about it. Yet all four gospel accounts give far more credence and weight to John the Baptist's witness of Jesus. You also never get any of the apostles in any of the rest of the New Testament pointing back to the fact of Jesus' virgin birth as being of any importance. There's no mention of it. So if Jesus is supposed to be ontologically the Son of God, biologically, in essence, the Son of God, then you would think that the apostles would really hone in on this fact. I think ultimately for me, where I've come to is that the virgin birth was important in that it was a miracle that God used to shine the light upon the importance of that individual and nothing more. So yes, it was a virgin birth. Yes, it was a miracle. And yes, God used it to shine the light of importance upon the individual who's going to come out of it. But in terms of it being any kind of weight that the apostles give to it to suggest that Jesus was of the same essence of God, there's just literally no teaching, explicit teaching on that in the New Testament. The only explicit teaching we have in the New Testament is that Jesus is the physical descendant of David and that he is resurrected from the dead, and that's what makes Jesus important to the apostles. Now, there's lots of verses that people like to go to, and maybe some of you have those, that seem to suggest something alternatively to what I'm suggesting, and if you want to ask me about those, you can. I would suggest that that I don't think that any of those verses do ultimately suggest something contrary to what I'm putting forth. Now, to bring this full circle and to kind of get us headed in the direction for next week. So what's the difference between the apostles' answer and the Council of Nicaea's answer regarding Jesus' qualifications to be the Son of God? Well, the apostles suggest that Jesus is the Son of God because of his physical relationship to David and his resurrection. While the Council of Nicaea's focus is that Jesus is God because he shares the physical essence with God, he was begotten, not made, and he was preexistent. Now, it seems to me when I read this stuff and when I'm looking at this stuff that these two different groups, the apostles and then this church council, are not even on the same page. It's like they're not even interested in the same things. The apostles don't seem to be interested at all in Jesus' ontological status. They're utterly focused on him being the Messiah and the Son of David, who God has affirmed by raising him from the dead, who will rule over the eternal kingdom of God and fulfill the promises to the Jews in the world. The council, on the other hand, is seems to have ironically zero interest in Jesus being the Messiah and the Son of God and the Son of David. They seem to be utterly focused on Jesus's biological, ontological identity with God himself. My contention is that if you don't have the Jewish Messiah and King of Kings, and if the apostles never make Jesus or point to Jesus as being the fulfillment, the fulfilling Messiah, then 300 years down the road, Jesus is a nonity, not a deity. I mean, unless Jesus is that physical descendant of David, he becomes history. We don't know about him. And so these two groups of people seem to be so focused in a different direction. And what I'm going to assert next week is that the Council of Nicaea and their focus on not Jesus's status as Messiah, but on his physical connection to God, that focus takes Christianity into an entirely different and new trajectory and really sort of divorces what made Jesus important to the apostles in the first place. And so none of this is, I don't believe I've stood up here and made a foolproof case. This is all just evidence that I'm trying to wade through and I'm trying to kind of consider. But I do hope that what you will walk out of here today with is this sense of, wow, the apostles were pretty focused on these two things. And those are two very different things than what Christianity has been focused on Jesus ever since the age of the apostles ended. So we'll talk next week about why I think when you get to the year 325 and this first major church council, the focus has so shifted from Jesus being the Son of David and Messiah to him being God of gods. And I'll lay out that history for you, and I will make some more disclaimers about that next week. So I'm going to stop there. Questions?
I like that. I like where you're going. That's cool. And my question is kind of just random. Is there any prophecy around the virgin birth?
Yeah, well.
And I'm with you. I don't know how much that really matters to me. I was just curious.
There is a prophecy that Matthew, when Matthew in his gospel speaks to Mary, I'm going to give birth to a child, he focuses on a prophecy back in Isaiah chapter 7 of a child who was going to be born to a virgin in the time of Ahaz, one of the kings of Israel. Actually, he's the king of Judah back in his time. And Ahaz had enemies coming against him, and he was very concerned that God was going to allow his enemies to overtake Judah and take them off into captivity. And so Isaiah is sent by God to Ahaz to tell him, Ahaz, don't worry. There's this virgin who is going to give birth to a child. And before that child is old enough to know good from, I can't remember the language, but before he gets very old, the enemies that you're worried about right now are going to go away. And so the prophecy was for the time of this king Ahaz, for a very short time later, the fulfillment of that prophecy took place. So, and it just happened to be the case that the name that Isaiah told Ahaz that this child was going to be given was Emmanuel, God with us. And, well, when this child comes along, no one believes that he's literally God in that time. It was this metaphor, this symbol to show that when this child is born, you'll know, Ahaz, that God is still for you. He's still with us as a people. So Matthew picks up on that and doesn't, I wouldn't say that Matthew suggests that what happened in Isaiah 7 is literally fulfilled with Jesus. There's this weird tension between how the apostles understood prophecy being fulfilled. Sometimes they'll point to an event that happened and was fulfilled in the past and say, this thing that's happening here and now is like that event. And that's that. Does that answer your question?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep.
I appreciate this. Very thought-provoking.
Oh, good.
But there are a lot of scriptures that seem to contradict what you're saying, mm-hmm. and it would be interesting to explore those. One, I'm just looking at Colossians chapter 1, starting in verse 15. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but for him, the firstborn of all, that he's the firstborn of all creation, by him all things are created. He's there before all things. In him all things hold together. It seems to be talking about Jesus, but...
Oh, I think he is talking about Jesus.
So how do you reconcile that? And then I can't think of where it is, but in King James, that's what I always memorized as a kid. He thought it not robbery to be equal with God, took upon himself the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. So it seems like there are a lot of scriptures that kind of contradict what you're mm-hmm. saying. I'd like to explore those too.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have time to go through and do service to all of those, but I think I could. Specifically with the Colossians passage, that's actually what I taught on a year and a half back. So I think that what we're suffering from there is that the translators for our Bibles have brought the assumption that I am suggesting started in 325 or prior to 325 at the Council of Nicaea, that Jesus is God. And so they're bringing those assumptions to the text, and they're translating the text in a way that I think sort of lends more credence to that perspective. So firstborn, for example, is a title that was given to David in Psalm 89. It seems to be a metaphorical title that with respect to David's status as God's heir, that as the son, he is heir of all that is God's. That is, he is going to rule over it. And I would suggest that it should read that he is the firstborn over creation. That is, he's going to rule over creation as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And then in terms of the verse that talks about him creating, I would suggest that that verb create is in the passive form, and that it is better translated, better understood, that all things were created for him as God's ultimate heir, as God's son. The preposition by can just as easily be translated for. So what I'm suggesting is that through the lens of the Davidic covenant and understanding that there was supposed to be a seed of David who was going to come and be the ultimate ruler over the heavens and the earth, that what Paul is suggesting is that one is Jesus. Jesus is the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant, and all creation is going to be made subject to him as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and it's for him. And in that sense, he's the firstborn. That's not adequate ultimately, but so each of those passages, I would suggest, based on their context, based on the lens of the Davidic covenant that I'm suggesting, can be, and more accurately, I think, are better understood in that light, if that makes sense. That's a lot for you to just, like, just hear in one moment. But I would love to talk with you more afterwards if you'd like. Oh, in the Philippians passage, you should talk to Rusty about that.
Thank you. I have a two-part thing. First, okay. I have not really been properly motivated in the past to want to really learn more about the council. Mm-hmm. But you've done that tonight for some reason. You've made me interested. And now I'm asking you for a little help. Do you have a recommendation for reading, getting a beginner when it comes to looking at the history of, you know, 325 AD, to look just to get a better feel for how the council, what they discussed, and and how to understand what they discussed.
Yeah, this is sort of a political answer that could be charged, but there's a book by Richard Rubenstein called "When Jesus Became God," and that book is specifically focused on sort of the historical narrative of what brought that council together, what transpired at the council, what were the issues, what were they fighting about, and what was its outcome, and that sort of thing. Another book that is not specifically about the council itself, but I've drawn on heavily in my thinking that I will share with you next week, that kind of traces the history of Christian thought from the apostles up through the Council of Nicaea, is called The History of Christian Thought by Paul Tillich. Again, that's a little bit of a politically charged author, because people seem to suggest that he's a radical, like, you know, non-conservative lunatic. But I think I find what he has to say very helpful in terms of tracing how it is that Jesus, well, just what the philosophical currents were that Christianity was part and parcel with in sort of the milieu as it moved out into the pagan culture after the age of the apostles, and how sort of those ideas started sort of working with and upon and interacting with Christianity and how we came to Jesus being very God of very gods in 325. So those two, and I'll think about some others.
Thank you for that. And then my question for you around tonight was, I can't remember if it was in 2 Samuel or in Isaiah, where God is telling David that, or telling somebody, maybe Samuel, he's telling Samuel that David's line will be big, and even if David, even when he screws up, mm-hmm. he's going to continue to give him the status and the authority. It kind of reminds me. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's the 2 Samuel passage.
Okay. Thank you. And my daughter just whispered that it was Nathan.
Yeah, Nathan, the prophet. Yeah.
Okay. So my question about that then. It reminds me a little bit of when Jesus mentions to Judas, that he knows he's going to deny him. Mm-hmm. I think I'm getting this right. Or Peter. I'm sorry. I think he tells Peter, after you deny me, you'll blah, blah, blah. He kind of predicts that he will deny him and that life will still go on. Okay, well, that's not the main point. Let me get to the main point.
Okay, it's good.
So would you be willing to speculate a little bit about the
I'm
importance, the significance of this text in terms of God saying, even when you make mistakes, even when you do a lousy job to David, I will still do what I have in mind.
So, I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. A little too much coffee and a little scattered thinking. Okay. The question is, what do you think the significance is in including the part about even when David makes mistakes in the future, he will still be my representative here, and his line and the promises will still keep.
So what do I think the significance of those is for me personally, existentially, or what do I think the significance is for Jesus?
Actually, I thought he was predicting that David would screw up, and maybe I have it all wrong.
So,
you're trying. Thank
correct
you.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think all he's saying is he is not in 2 Samuel 7 prophesying the perfect Christ man. But what he is saying is that David, you and your descendants, even if and when you fail, I am not going to pull my faithfulness from your line as getting to continue to be ruler over Israel. So that would be true for David. That would be true for Solomon. I mean, the heart of that is, David, you can be sure that no matter what, you will always have a descendant on the throne of Israel. In the face of and in light of what happened to Saul, and how God pulled his faithfulness from Saul's rule, that was, I think, the main impetus for saying what he said there, if that makes sense.
That does make sense.
Okay.
Thank you. And I think there's another question brewing, but maybe I'll just, go home and pass it on for right now.
Okay.
Thanks for trying with
me. Yeah, no problem.
Okay, and
no
so
problem.
Sorry, everyone else.
From your presentation tonight, it sounds like Nicaea was trying to de-Israelize, mm-hmm. de-Jewify Christ.
Yeah.
It sounds like they wanted to Gentilize him.
Well, had already been done. So it was well just complete by that time.
Okay.
Yeah.
The importance of the nation Israel and God's chosen mm-hmm. people.
Yeah.
And our understanding of the Old Testament mm-hmm. prophecies and stories and how those people lived and God's interaction with them becomes more and more important, that we understand the Old Testament,
mm-hmm.
because that Jewifies Christ and the importance of his Jewishness. It's pretty huge.
Yeah. No, that's, I don't think I could have said it better. That's absolutely right.
I'm so glad we went.
So if I understand what you're saying correctly, this controversy hinges on who Jesus is. You're saying that the apostles working from an Old Testament understanding would have seen Jesus as essentially a human being like any other human being who has the authority of who God has given his authority on earth to. The alternative is Jesus is not just an ordinary human. He is actually, as Jack, I think, would describe this perspective, he has the same social security number as the transcendent God does. He has identity with God, but somehow whatever the transcendent God is has been wrapped in flesh, mm-hmm. enfleshed.
Mm-hmm.
So he is not, it would be a real mistake to describe him as an ordinary human being. So have I got the controversy and what you're saying here?
Well, I think so. I just want to clarify one thing.
Okay.
I'm saying ontologically he is...
I'm not sure I know what you mean by
okay,
ontologically.
I'm saying in terms of... Sorry. Thank you. Ontologicness refers to the makeup of something, the being of something, and or the essence of something. And so I'm saying that Jesus's biological essence was no different than ours. But I do have a couple caveats with respect to his uniqueness with respect to us in other ways. I think that John puts it very interestingly in John 1 when he talks about the Logos being made flesh and that the unique Son of God has explained God. That there is something about the way Jesus was constituted, the way Jesus was made, that he and he alone, different from David, different from Solomon, different from me, he and he alone would be the bearer of the most perfect image that anyone could have of who Yahweh was in the form of a man. But I'm suggesting that he was created that way.
But is that something that's unique to him now? But after we are perfected, redeemed, you know, we are completely mm-hmm. sanctified,
mm-hmm.
won't that be true of us also? We won't have Jesus' authority, but we will have the same moral character.
Yes, absolutely. I think
so
that's right.
So in that respect, Jesus is only unique temporarily. He's unique permanently in terms of his authority.
Right.
But in terms of his moral character, he's only unique temporarily.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what Paul kind of gets at in Romans and Colossians when he calls him the firstborn from the dead and the firstborn of many brethren, that he has gone ahead of us and he has become what we will become.
We will be like him because we will see him as he is.
So does that answer your question?
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying I have understood what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
part two.
So I like it. It makes a lot of sense. Like, for instance, one of the things I've always wondered about the book of Hebrews is here you have the writer of the book of Hebrews, you know, let's say Paul, is dealing with people saying Jesus can't be a big deal because he's just a man.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd think that if he had the same social security number as the transcendent God and somehow had a unique kind of divinity in him, that instead of saying, you know, to which of these angels did he say, you know, this is my beloved son,
mm-hmm.
You know, today I have begotten you and that kind of thing. Why doesn't he just come out and say, dig it, the guy is identical with the transcendent God. The transcendent mm-hmm. God has been wrapped in flesh. So obviously he's not just a human being, but he never makes that argument.
Right.
He's arguing based on God says, this is my guy.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say, this guy is me, which it would make perfect sense if it was Jesus's ontological identity with God. You know, why wouldn't he make an argument that way? So that makes a lot of sense there. Mm-hmm. So my second question is, do I have to answer the question, how should I understand Jesus's identity, ontological identity? Do I have to understand that, be able to answer that correctly to be saved?
Sure.
well, good.
No, I think Kierkegaard says it really well. He says that how can any of our eternal happinesses be based upon, what's the word he uses, be based upon an approximation, and that all of this stuff in the end is an approximation. We're trying to do the best with what information we have. I think we're making some good approximations, but I think ultimately, are we willing to bow our knee to Jesus as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, regardless of his ontology? Then I think we're good. Okay, I should let you go. I'd be happy to talk to anyone else afterwards.